Chapter 10. What I'm going to try to do this morning, and we've got limited time, you can't do everything that you want to do, obviously, in a short amount of time, but I'm hoping to try to bring together even a few of the things that you probably have heard from both David Sitton, our president, and then Steve Best, the director of our training school, the Center for Pioneer Church Planting. Bring together some places. I've got a number of pictures that I want to show you, some videos about places where we minister, things that we do, but also, and for me more importantly, just try to give you a clearer understanding of who we are as a missionary organization, both a training school, a sending agency. What's the passion of our heart, and what is the primary ministry that we believe God has given us? So texts like Matthew chapter 10 that for me are becoming increasingly both more personal and just more real, more alive when we recognize that even what you're doing here, for example, think a mission conference in a fundamental Bible-believing church, wonderful. Can't thank you enough for doing it. And lots of churches used to have week-long mission conferences, and sadly they're becoming a thing of the past too often. So commend you for what you're doing. Loved hearing about so many of the missionaries that you support and the years you've done it. And again, just as a fellow believer and somewhat a missionary, not quite to the extent of those going cross-culturally and overseas, but I thank you and I applaud you in that regard. But it strikes me that a mission conference for a group of Christians is maybe kind of similar to getting a room full of children and having a conference on eating. Isn't that just what we do? Isn't that the whole point? We come to Christ, and it's mission. That's lifeblood. That's not add on. So, in fact, we try to even be careful in our vernacular at To Every Tribe. We rarely even use the word missions, plural. Not because there's anything at all wrong with it, other than too often for too many people who don't seriously think through it, it is just kind of denoting an add on. Well, yeah, we have missions. You know, we do some things with missions, and we would rather prefer to talk about mission. Just who we are as believers and Christians and followers of Jesus Christ. So whether it's Rothbury, Michigan, or Grand Rapids, or Lewisburg, Pennsylvania, my hometown, or Brownsville, Texas, or Mexico, or Papua New Guinea, or any, we're on a mission. And it's to do the work of Jesus Christ in a lost and dying world. Amen? So texts like Matthew chapter 10, look at it with me, even beginning with verse 37. There's so many here in the Gospels of things that Jesus says that when we're only thinking of missions, kind of add-on, tacked on to something that people who are just fanatical do that are Christian. And then you hear, anyone who loves his father or mother more than me, Jesus, now speaking, and I know it's Jesus, because it's in red in my Bible. So I've got a hint here. Anyone who loves his father or mother more than me is not worthy of me. And I'm here to tell you, I'm a mama's boy, or was. The last of three children, two older sisters who loved even now to remind me that I was mom's favorite. And I really was, so what can I say? it's really the truth. We have a lot of fun with it. But this verse, it's kind of almost unnerving. It's a little bit, what on earth is he talking about? And anyone who does not take his cross and follow me is not worthy of me. Whoever finds his life will lose it, and whoever loses his life for my sake will find it. He who receives you receives me, and he who receives me receives the one who sent me. And so there's these verses that, again, for me are just so very important. Go back over to Matthew chapter 16 again. And similar language. Again, over and over in the scriptures, we see this. Then Jesus said to his disciples, if anyone would come after me, not come later in time, but follow. In other words, imitate me, be my disciple. If anyone would come after me, he must deny himself. Now, we all live in a culture in 21st century America where you don't need to be told anything you don't already know. Self-denial is not a virtue that we are real comfortable even talking about, let alone trying to practice. Self-denial, when in fact everything under the sun preaches and declares to me that I am the most important thing in the universe. And it's not so subtle, both in the market media and even, unfortunately, in some so-called areas of theology. But anyone, Jesus says, that would come after him must deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. For whoever wants to save his life will lose it. But whoever loses his life for me will find it. What good is it? What good will it be for a man if he gains the whole world yet forfeits his soul? Or what can a man give in exchange for his soul? And so again, texts like this that we're not going to spend a lot of time on this morning, wish we could, and certainly well worth our time and energy, but I just want to set that as the background and the framework. Self-denial, taking up our cross and following Jesus Christ, thereby losing our lives in order to find his life. That's not just for missionaries or pastors or elders. That's being a Christian. And maybe, and this is one of my increasing concerns, maybe this whole concept of Christianity has been so either just kind of set aside or almost completely abandoned that we now think that the kind of Christianity that maybe most of us tend to be living is really normal when in fact it's really abnormal. We don't look a lot like Jesus Christ. We don't act a lot like Jesus Christ. We don't even talk a lot like Jesus Christ. In most other situations other than 9:30 till about quarter to 12 or whenever it is you get out of Sunday morning service. That concerns me about me. And it concerns me about those of us who name the name of Christ and call ourselves Christian. So let me just, for a second, I'm going to step to the side here just so I can be out of your way. And I don't know if we can dim these lights, if that helps at all, if you can see. Not sure all of these slides. One of the most important slides for me is that's my wife. And I wish desperately she could be here. We met at Grand Rapids Baptist, now Cornerstone. She from Minnesota, me from Michigan. And I've been away about 3 weeks, so forgive me if I just kind of stare. Second most important picture is this is my tribe that God's given me. 13 grandchildren, ages 8 and under, with 14 on the way. They all live within 5 minutes of us in Lewisburg. And pray for me. Pray for me. We have so much fun, it's almost sinful. We embrace the word and the concept of martyrdom at To Every Tribe. That maybe is not the most profitable way starting a message for people to be told about being a martyr. But if you also notice, and I'd forgotten this when this is a slide I put together a few years ago, it's the word mission, not missions, mission martyrdom, And we looked at a couple of the texts there in Matthew chapter 10, denying ourselves, Matthew 16, taking up our cross. We didn't even look at Mark chapter 8. But go to Acts chapter 1, verse 8, and probably most of you even here would have that memorized. And if you had a top three list of verses that somebody that was going to talk about mission might use, Acts 1, 8 very likely would be in that list. I want to show you something that even for me, I have to confess, after a 23-year pastorate in the same church, was kind of a revelation. And in this verse, we're told that we will receive power when the Holy Spirit comes upon us, and we will be His witnesses in Jerusalem, in all Judea and Samaria, and to the ends of the earth. And I have heard, like most of you, I'm sure, maybe hundreds, certainly scores of messages, if you've spent any time in a Bible-believing fundamental church, on this text. What was the revelation to me is that English word witnesses in the Greek. Does anybody offhand happen to know what it is? Maybe David even shared this, used this text. It's the word martyreo. Well, I'm not a genius, and I certainly wasn't an English major. But it doesn't take a genius to figure out that that Greek word is the word from the that we put into the English language that is the root word for martyr. You will be my martyrs. Can you imagine in the first century church a letter, a verse, a conversation that Jesus declares to his disciples, you're going to be my martyrs. Now, how do you think they would have thought of that in that context? You know, we talk about martyrdom, we talk about taking up our cross, and if it's somebody doesn't say hello to us in the morning service, you know, that's our cross to bear. Trust me, it's a little bit deeper than that. That doesn't quite get the essence of what's being communicated here. You will lose your life. Physically, early church, obviously, down through church history, certainly. We're told today that, and this may even be a little bit old statistic, the amount of people who experience martyrdom for the cause of Christ, and that's a little bit narrowly defined here, but the amount of people who are killed in the world is about the size of the city of Fort Lauderdale, Florida, every year. It's still happening, friends. Trust me. You will be my martyrs. And I take that even beyond that. I've told David. David and I met in the early 80s. I had gone to the little church in central Pennsylvania that I pastored for 23 years in 1978 in my mid to late 20s. David had gone to Papua New Guinea 2 weeks after his 20th birthday in 1977. And we met about 1980, he returning just to raise support and traveled around and came to my church. And we've supported him ever since, become certainly dear friends as well as now co-workers. And I can remember saying to him, David, I got a harder job than you do. You're only ministering to cannibals. I've got to preach to Americans. We're not talking the same language, you know. I've been in a few meetings where I felt like maybe they wanted to bite my head off, but they didn't literally, like sometimes David almost experienced. But it was this whole sense of trying to get us out of this comfortable, almost state of euphoria that we're being taught more and more, that safety, that prosperity, that's really the sign and evidence of God's blessing. When in fact, in my opinion, increasingly, it may be just the opposite. People talk about, well, if we don't get straightened out, His wrath's going to be on us. And I respond, I think maybe you're a little bit late. I think His wrath's already on us, and He's removing His hand of restraint. And it's not because we're these terrible, rotten, filthy sinners. It may be, as Spurgeon talked about, the white devil, not the black one, of indifference and static status quo within the body of believers. So this verse means something to me. I hope it means something to you all as well. And it really lays the foundation. We embrace the concept because of both where we know we're sending people in many third world situations and what they are going to face for the cause of Christ may well result, and we believe will result in some cases, in actual physical martyrdom, persecution, suffering, injury, if not then even death. But again, as I say to David, it goes way beyond that. They can only kill my body. But what happens before that? What is the cause of Christ worth? Where's the line that we draw that we say, well, I'll go this far, but you know, don't ask me to do something really horrible like, you know, go to Mexico and eat their food. I've had a preacher tell me that. That's not quite, I think, what was intended in these verses. So real basic, broad statistic, maybe you've heard of this, and so much of this, again, remember, I'm hoping things David or Steve have already brought to your attention. I'm going to try to pull some things together and help you understand our ministry. 7 billion plus now people on this planet called Earth, and in the category of what we would refer to as unreached, unengaged, depending on your language, your terminology, essentially never having ever even once heard a credible gospel presentation in their own language. Unreached, no boots on the ground, nobody there ministering, no evidence in the near future, anybody going there. Unreached people group out of that 7 billion, about a third, 3 billion of the people that currently live on this planet. And I almost always share this statistic because it amazes me how many of us, including myself, live so much of our lives and we don't even grasp the concept that anybody, we live in America, we have churches literally on every street corner, and there's people who've never heard ever, once, not just in their lifetime, but the history of their culture, not one. How many messages have you heard about Christ? And have I heard? And so we talk about our mission and vision, and it is literally, we have 4 keywords: the mobilizing, training, sending, ultimately to plant churches or among the unreached. That's our target. That's our focus. Unreached. That's primarily the reason we exist, among a couple of others that we just don't have time to get into all that. But our focus is on unreached people groups around the world. That's who we seek in the mobilizing, training, sending, and planning. Now, that's the David Sitton you met, right? Is that pretty fair? He probably even had a tie on up here. He's such a hypocrite. He's never in a tie. He's got this ratty T-shirt and, of all things, a Green Bay Packer. He is the ultimate Green Bay Packer fan. He gets along real well with Steve Best, who also shares that passion. But this is the David Sitton you met. This is the real David Sitton. I love this picture. I love this. I love it because there's young people in this congregation, and you are not even aware of how God may use your life for the rest of, you're not even thinking maybe even about Christianity, let alone overseas mission. But I'm here to tell you, God is on the throne, and if he has purposed to have you, he's going to have you. And you're going to be better off. And so a kid that grew up in Corpus Christi, he said, and this was after he'd gotten his hair cut. He said it was so long. He used to, he was a sometimes high school class attender and a full-time surfer is the way I describe him in hearing his story. He said, my hair was so long I used to tuck it in the back of my pants. And then he gets radically converted and decides, knowing the horrible lifestyle of most people that were involved in what he was so fond of, that whole surfing lifestyle and community, the immorality, the illicit sex, drugs, godlessness. He said, these people need Christ, and I'm going to go be a missionary to surfers. And is quite frankly, ultimately, how he first got to Papua New Guinea. There is world-class surfing off the east coast of Papua New Guinea, as God often does. This is literally a picture taken in his living room the day he left. He arrived in New Guinea with a suitcase, a surfboard, and a Bible, and was planning to spend the rest of his life ministering to surfers. Met Joe Cannon, a veteran missionary, really old guy. I think he was 50. By David's standards and all of us that were can remember our 20s and teens. This old guy, and Joe got a hold of David, and he said, I've just heard about an undiscovered, unengaged people group. And he said, I'm getting to the place where physically I can't do these five-day walks through the mountains, but you're young. Together we can reach them. And some of you I know have heard about the Kuka Kuka tribe that David went to as the first group. And I hear there's someone here that had some experience with the Kuka Kukas. And trust me, I want to meet you after the service. There's a picture David very likely showed. And I'm not going to even tell you their story again. Hopefully you remember some of that. This is footage of either the 60s or 70s of a sing sing among the Kuka Kuka tribe that David had gone to. And I don't know if he shared with you, he thinks he may have very well been the first or second white person they ever saw in history. He said some of their women actually came up and would lick his skin. That was the way they kind of identified with each other. But this is really special footage to us. Practicing cannibals. David started living among the tribals, and much of the mission that we too today have its roots in his 15-plus years in Papua New Guinea, the way he just basically built relationships with people, shared the gospel, we call it obedience-oriented training, communicated to them to be a follower of Christ is not just to hear about him or say, I love you, I believe you, I'm a Christian, but to do what Jesus did. To live a life of obedience. And so he, things like learning how to shoot bows and arrows and just interacting. And if you listen real close, you can almost hear the arrows. Isn't that amazing? Sitting, talking in the huts around campfires, just sharing the gospel, seeing the fruit. How many of you know when Jesus is preached, people get converted? The Spirit of God moves. And we expect these converts and then disciple them, do very little, if any more, public ministry once some come to Christ, because our intent is to disciple those believers so they in turn will be the leaders of that local congregation who will go out and reach others that need to hear about him. So many stories. You heard of Prisca? Did you hear Prisca? This is... Prisca is one of the most amazing Christians I have ever met. Amazing person. Evidence of Christ's work. Early 1990s, David, through a series of circumstances, loses his full-time missionary visa, has to come home, and he's devastated. Don't know if he told you a story, but wanted to go back, did everything he could to get back. The pastor then of his home church said, David, this is of God. You could do far more by training others to do what you did than by just doing it yourself. The whole beginning of a thought of a training school sending agency had its roots back then. We started doing trips into Mexico. We were looking, obviously, Brownsville, Los Fresnos, where David lived, is only about 15 minutes from the Mexico border. In the course of about a decade, we took 3,000 plus people in and out of Mexico just on short-term trips. Logistical nightmares, we were insane. It was to be the beginning of reaching into villages, and God has blessed that, but it was one of the hardest things, bringing in 100 people at a time, renting vans, working out the logistics to get them into villages in northern Mexico, like this one on the Laguna de Madre, Media Luna. But God, the fruit of that, we have students now working in these same villages. There's evidence of conversions. A church will be established, and God's work will continue in this region in Tamaulipas. We used to go into the mountains, pitch tents, take in medical trips. People, this was 8 hours, 8 to 10 hours of people. These villages in Oaxaca are so isolated and so remote, the people don't even speak Spanish. They speak Indian dialects like Mixtec. And so for our students that go in, typically they first learn Spanish because there are some that can communicate that way and it's kind of a base, then learn the mother tongue of whatever particular village they're in. But even in these days, the people that would stand there, again, one of my favorite slides, this elderly, older, little, short, tiny couple came up the last day of one of our medical clinics in Jicaral, and we found out she was completely deaf and he was totally blind. And I thought, what a physical picture of what God has called us to as a ministry. Places, people, parts of the world, around the world, where people are spiritually deaf, blind, dead, and have never even once heard a gospel presentation of Jesus Christ. We continued to go back to New Guinea, take short-term trips of 3, 4, 5 weeks, taking just then anyone that would go with us, and now ultimately students. You know, you can take trucks, canoes, or I never have had this experience. Some of them have airstrips that you can usually even fly in. But typically we take our canoes in and continue to minister to people like the Chambri. You heard the Machete Bob story? This is Carimbe. This is Chambri Island within the swamp they call Chambri Lakes. You hope there's enough water, it's a lake. And these guys would have been not cannibals, they would have been headhunters a couple decades ago. There's still 3 stones by one of the spirit houses that's soaked at the top, red, stained red with the blood of the corpses they would have thrown over those stones after they'd chopped their heads off. These guys were not typically dressed that way, but not too long before that would have been. Their fathers, having been practicing headhunters, putting on a little sing-sing for us. Churches I go to, I tell the music department, I could get a couple of these guys in your choir. I have church music people say, I've got a couple guys like that in my choir. Thank you very much. 2006, 2004, we got our nonprofit status. 2006, we literally started the first class of the Center for Pioneer Church Planting. We had 5 students, all single, ranging from mid-50s to just out of high school, and had no idea where this was going to take us. As I said, we were in a rented church building, met, had classes, had only like an 8-month training course at that particular period of time. Right after graduation, the fellows said, you know, we need to start looking for property. We purchased, a couple of months later, an apartment building, had 8 apartments. We took the wall out between a couple of bedrooms and had a long, skinny classroom for a couple of years. A few months after purchasing the apartment, we were able to buy 2 duplexes right next door, and we remodeled them into a classroom and an office spaces. And then just a few months later, while we were back in New Guinea, we were able to purchase the last two vacant lots. And within 24 months of buying the first apartment building, we owned the entire city block debt-free. And boy, we thought we were absolutely set and we were going to be able to do mission for lots of years. Not this past January, but the January before that, we had an open house and 30 people showed up, either interested in our missionary training or even coming on staff, before the weekend was over, 16 of them had submitted applications for the training school, and we were already filled up. We only had 8 apartments to begin with, and so 6 students filled us up. 16, we immediately started construction on a new apartment building in the vacant lot, and knowing that even then it was already filled up. And we demonstrated pretty quickly not only that we didn't have enough room for students, we had to move all of our offices off that campus. We were filled and overflowing. We began looking for other property. It was about a 2-year or more search. Lots of stories we could share, but went from 5 students to last year our class was 26. And most of the years since the first couple of years, our classes have not been single students primarily, but 2/3 of these classes have been students with families and even small children, families in their early, mid, late 20s and 30s. So we've been amazed at what God has done. We've expanded our training. As we talk about mobilizing, it's kind of what we're doing here, just trying to educate people about who we are and what we do and why. The training, we moved from an 8-month training course to a 2-year program. And in that 2 years, and the reason we did it, sadly, in my opinion, the statistic that's frequently quoted nowadays is that the average so-called full-time lifelong missionary, the average length of time they stay on the field is 2.5 years. And we think something is horribly wrong with that statistic. And we think a good part of it is they are not adequately prepared for what they're going to. So we have kind of an apprenticeship style approach. 60% of the 2 years is in classroom work and 40% is in the field. Being only 15 minutes from Mexico, very often we will do classes in both missiology and theology, redemptive analogies, cross-cultural, contextualization, theology classes, Bible study, systematic theology within the 2-year period of time, and bring in people like Don Richardson, who wrote Peace Child. Jerry Bridges does something for us every year in terms of the biblical person. And so we'll have classes for a week, week and a half, there in Los Fresnos, and then they'll go into the villages in the northern part of the country and spend a few days ministering in teams. We don't send out single individuals. We send out teams of 3 units. And then they'll come back, and they'll have a week or 2 more of classes, and then they'll go back into the village. And they'll do that for the period of 2 years, not just learning about mission, but doing mission. Because we believe that the way you're trained is the way you're going to teach. And we want believers, we want new believers, new converts to understand you don't just sit and listen about Jesus, you do the work of ministry for Jesus. You follow him, you act like him and his disciples. And so villages like La Poza certainly look a little bit strange and different to us, but it's the places where they continue their work, then get sent, and obviously because of our close proximity to Mexico, we have teams there, Papua New Guinea. We've been exploring new countries this past year, Indonesia, India, Turkey. And so as our students go into some of these countries, Indonesia took a group into India this year in the month of February, and just seeking where God might desire them to go to do the work of planting churches. Like this couple, and we can kind of finish up with this. This is the Sisson family, came from Birmingham, Alabama, the last person on earth, former Marine, or they say once a Marine, always a Marine, came on a short-term mission trip, had already married his high school sweetheart, decided he wanted to come to our training, came a few years ago when we still only had 4, 5, 6 students a year, sat in on our classes. He's the one with the bald head. Oh, wait a minute, they've all got bald heads. Kind of the team haircut for a couple of years for some reason. Went into our apprenticeship training, going in and out of Mexico, talking with villagers. Went to New Guinea with us, determined that's where God would have them go, has ministered there now a term, and God has blessed. We are so excited about the particular area he's in and around Goroka, and then the CPIC in Blackwater, and now have just gone back for their second term. So pray for the Sisson family, not Sitton, pray for them as well, but Sisson's Alex and Kelly, I can't even keep up with them now. They've got four children, just had a baby here while they were on furlough. But pray for them. These are the kinds of families that are coming, losing their life to find it, taking up their cross, not a cross of, oh, you know, we got to go be missionaries, a cross of obedience, a cross of martyrdom to their own plans and goals and even values, and seeking to follow Christ, as well as last year's group of graduates and now this year's class. 29 students, some two-thirds of them as well with families. We've got 29 children on our little property now. It looks more like this in a rented room, and that's not even including all the staff and other people. And we want to just praise God and ask you to pray. This is what we look like today in Los Fresnos, and this is a property, I don't know if you've heard from David or Steve, we've just purchased a 50-acre property 3 miles from Los Fresnos, and we're now shifting all of our operations. Everybody lives on the old property, and they go 3 miles to class. All our offices are there. And as God is pleased to provide funds, we'll begin building our buildings and moving everything. So leave you with this. It's not about our training. It's not about our facilities, for sure. It's not about our program. It's about the billions of nameless faces that have never once heard the gospel of Jesus Christ. Would you prayerfully consider? You may not ever be a goer. Not everybody will. Not everybody should. But everybody's to be a follower, a discipler of Jesus Christ. Would you sacrifice yourself, possessions, resources, talents? We need a tremendous number of staff people in Texas and other people. Would you consider how you might help change, put a dent, as I think the pastor prayed, in these billions that are unreached for the name of Jesus Christ?